Maybe this is a good thing.
I think so.
Okay, if we can begin with apologies. As you can tell, we've been having some discussions at the front of the table because my intent really was to start it right at 8 o'clock. But we have Senate File 3295, Senator Langseth.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think a number of you are on the Capital Investment Committee, so I'm not going to spend much time in details here, and you can certainly ask whatever questions you wish, but just kind of going through it fairly briefly. In the higher education area, it's about one-third of the bill. That's kind of the normal amount that we try to get out, carve out of the bonding bills for higher education, $133 million state share for the university, and about $200 million for Minsku. And I don't know I don't suppose you really need to go line by line here. Your job, I guess, is really more the financial end of it.
Well, Senator Langseth, as you pointed out, a number of us are on your committee and obviously have gone through the details of the bill. Not everyone's on the committee, although I think your committee now has got, what, like 50 members or something?
Yeah, it's got about half the Senate. Yeah.
15 is half.
So I don't know if there are highlights you want to emphasize. I certainly know in particular what I would like to get from you, and there's a spreadsheet that's, I believe, in the packets, and you probably have it, of the general fund dollars. I'll want a little bit of explanation of that, because obviously this committee, and you're no longer on this committee, so you don't get to share in the work where we have to cover your appropriation.
Well, on the back page, you can see that box we've got there. Well, that is the general fund money. And it's a total of $30,455,000. And if you want to go through those line by line, that's fine.
Yeah, we'd like to have just a couple minutes on that. And actually, there's another spreadsheet that Mr. Mossman prepared, I think. Do you not have that?
No.
We don't have that, but I suppose it probably says the same thing that this one.
Well, it's, I think, a little bit more detailed. Let's make sure you get one. If we can have one for Sir Langseth and Ms. Blair, Mr. Jensen.
But I could, since it's very pertinent to this committee, I could just go through those general fund items and explain why they need to be general fund. You remember the Browns Valley flood. It was all over television down here and so on. The big problem is that the river comes out of South Dakota, goes through Browns Valley, goes back into South Dakota. In order to prevent floods in the future, they need a diversion channel. It needs to be in South Dakota, so we can't bond for it. So the $3.9 million is for a diversion channel on the South Dakota side, and South Dakota has agreed to it, and that is the reason that has to be a general fund. The Red River Basin digital elevation mapping, that is a situation that has been agreed upon between North Dakota and Minnesota, and North Dakota has already funded it. A plane flies over at a certain height, and it takes photographs of the ground, and they can tell within, I think it's 6 inches of what the elevation of the ground is. And by putting that in the computer and so on, whenever they make certain crests of the river, it can show exactly what every acre, the depth of water on every acre in the Red River Valley. And so that was in the bill last year that was vetoed, and so it's back here again. And they said that even though this information lasts for over 20 years, they said that it really had to be cash. Now, Wildlife Rehab Center, maybe you could explain that better than I can.
Mr. Chair, that's in Roseville, and I think it's affiliated with the university. That was something we had in last year's bill.
So why is that a cash appropriation?
Yeah, I guess I didn't quite understand that.
Right, it was cash in last year's bill, but I'm not sure.
For some reason, it has to be cash rather than bonding.
Mr. Chairman,
Watson.
I believe the reason is because it's a facility that's owned by the private organization, the nonprofit organization. Okay. It's not owned by any public entity.
Okay, I understand that.
Okay,
that,
but
registration for the local.
Senator Langseth, just on that point. But that's the that's the fight we always go through with some of these. And I'm one of the people who started the utilization of a bonding bill with nonprofits. And there's always that argument about we don't want to, you know, we don't want to be owned by the city. So if this is a private entity, are we treating this particular private entity differently than allowing them cash as opposed to having the fee owner be the city?
We probably are. It was in last year's bill, and it did come out of the House. But,
okay.
I mean, it's up to you. I mean,
well, with the general fund request, I mean, obviously the difficulty, and members of this committee better be aware of this, that whatever dollar amount we pass out of this committee in this bill, whether it be $1 million in cash or $50 million in cash, you add it to the deficit. This isn't free money. So for $500,000, I'm not going to get into a big argument. But Senator Langstaff, you and I just had a conversation about policy. Creating new policy in the bonding bill. I would argue this creates a new policy in the bonding bill. So,
well, you know, I'm here to point out inconsistencies. It isn't my deal by any means, and if this committee were to decide to do something different there, that's up to you.
All right. Senator Frederickson.
And then the biofields pilot project.
Senator Langstaff, excuse me. Wait, Senator Frederickson.
A word about the Wildlife Rehabilitation Center.
Yeah, and Senator Ferguson, I'm not suggesting it's brand new. I'm just wondering about the inclusion of cash for the purpose in lieu of bonding dollars. So,
okay.
Senator Langstaff?
Yeah, $3 million for that clean energy, which this is connected with, and this is the administrative cost of it. So I guess maybe it's a little more important than I was thinking.
Okay.
And then biofuels project, that is the governor's recommendation on that one, and that's the administration of it. And then that urban partnership, there's quite a lot of money involved there, $9 million cash money. And, remember after the bridge went down, the federal government came up with $130 million, and I don't know quite what it's all for, but we needed to come up with $50 million. Some of that ended up in the transportation bill. And, quite a bit of it is in this bill as well, both cash and bonding. And then the administrative expenses for PCA and PFA, that's that line. Streamline. What's the next line?
Yeah, I don't know what that is either. Do you know about that streamline restriction?
Mr. Chairman, members,
Jensen.
$100,000 is a one-time appropriation. After the first year, then there will be like user fees, loan repayments to continue the infrastructure program, trying to make it easier for smaller cities to apply for and get the money. So this is just a one-time appropriation.
The next fairly large amount is Lewis and Clark Rural Water System, $5,282,000. A while back, we had it in our bill as cash. We were told by the then Commissioner of Finance it could be bonding. So we changed it to bonding. Now the Commissioner of Finance says it has to be cash. So now it's once again cash, and we're canceling out the bonding portion. So I don't know. I guess it's whatever the last word is from the Commissioner of Finance is what we go with. And, but that project brings water from South Dakota. It's actually a three-state project, and there's a lot of federal money in it, and it will help these cities in southwestern Minnesota. Some of them are in a situation where a prolonged drought, and they simply will have no water. So it's a very, very important project. And the state is just coming up with their share of it. I don't know if there's any further comments on that. Then Upper Sioux Community Water System Improvement, that was something that has been in our proposal before, but that has to be cash simply because it's not on a public entity. So that is it for the cash.
Except for one thing, and that's why this is on this spreadsheet, that there's an additional $5 million. Your total bill is, including cash, is $965. Is that correct?
That's correct.
But the debt service provided in...
No, just bonding. Just bonding.
I'm sorry, just bonding. Okay. And the debt service provided in last year's budget would only represent a 645 bill. Is that correct?
Yeah, they've got a rather goofy way of figuring in the projections. And I think it was the average bonding for the previous 10 years with no inflation, not counting for the fact we paid cash for that $990 million one. So that's all that's in the projections. So the difference between the projection and what we do requires additional...
So that's the additional $5 million cash to provide the additional debt service. And the other question I wanted to ask, am I correct that with the passage of the transportation bill, that second appropriation to the Met Council, the $4 million, is not needed?
We've been told that, yes. That
okay.
Could be done with $4 million less.
All right. I don't know if there's an amendment.
In this bill.
I don't think there's an amendment prepared, but, again, I want to emphasize to everybody that if we pass this bill out, $30 million or $26 million in cash, and just a comment to all the finance division chairs at this table, where we've been going through the exercise of preparing cuts for various levels of a proposed or projected deficit, you know, the next exercise is going to be to cover the cash in this bill. So just so everybody understands, there's no free money in this thing. You know, it's great to pass a bonding bill, and it's a lot of fun. But we're going to have to, when this bill leaves, do the heavy lifting. It adds that much more to the deficit. In the transportation bill that we passed out of this committee, we had something like $3.6 billion added to the deficit. This adds, and Senator Murphy cut down significantly to help with
Senator Cohen, did you say $3.6 billion?
Yes,
no, million, I meant.
Million, okay.
Million, I'm sorry.
I didn't think I caused that much of a problem.
No. $3.6 million in the transportation bill. This, if the $4.003 million is not needed, that's still almost $26.5 million. I'm aware of one other bill that we'll probably hear in the near future, and that's the Victims Compensation Fund, which in the House is tagged at $40 million. And so take that $935 million deficit and just add on top of that. So just so everybody understands, and I hope all the division chairmen voting for the bonding bill will now go be willing to rework their budgets to make up for these bills that we're passing out. So Senator Langseth is kind of smiling because he's no longer on this committee. And doesn't have to work.
Setting myself up against all the budget chairs, that's no problem.
Okay. Let me also ask Senator Langseth, one of the things that this bill is being presented as is, you know, a jobs bill, kind of our stimulus bill. What the economists will tell you when Dr. Stinson's here later, I think what he would suggest is that What really makes a stimulus bill is if you can get the money into the economy tomorrow. How much of this is – I know because a lot of this has been left over from last year and even 2 years ago. How much of this will be ready to go fairly quickly?
Well, we hear like from higher education, for example. I mean, the design and so on has already been done. It would just be a matter of getting the bids out, and that's why it's very important to get it done by March 15th, which the governor had said. And many of these projects could begin this summer. And when it comes to the asset preservation, and there's a lot of it in this bill, That can be done very, very quickly. And in fact, we don't even have to wait for the frost to go out of the ground on a lot of that. But we would be able to get moving with a number of these. We have asked that question of many of the people that are pushing for different projects, and many of them have said that they're all ready to go.
All right. Other questions, discussion prior to amendments for Senator Langseth?
I think we got
three. Hey, Senator Langseth?
Yeah, there's a technical amendment. A3, Peter, I think you can probably explain that.
None of this stuff went in.
Mr. Chairman, there should be in your pile of papers right below the bill summary a summary of the technical amendment, the A3 amendment. I'll just read through that. The amendment to page 7, lines 12 and 13, corrects the description of the Smart Classroom Center to be constructed on the campus of Metro State University. The renovation will be to the old power plant building, not to the St. John's Hall next door. Appropriation also includes money to demolish the power plant annex to enable the new construction. The amendment to page 19, line 23, deletes a reference to constructing siphons at the Canisteo mine pit because siphons are not needed for the project and the language may preclude more viable options. The amendment to page 20, line 21, adds Dawson to the list of communities for which no match is required if the cost of the project exceeds 2% of the median household income in the municipality, multiplied by the number of households in the municipality. The amendment to page 22, line 18, clarifies that the appropriation for fish hatchery improvements may be used to design, construct, or acquire drainable ponds and other facilities for removing walleye rearing out of natural wetlands. Amendment to page 22, line 33, deletes fee titles as interests in land that may be purchased for native prairie conservation and protection since Minnesota Statute Section 84.96, which establishes the Native Prairie Bank program, says that they may only be acquired by easement and not by fee title. The amendment to page 23, lines 25 to 28, deletes the requirement of a two-for-one match for conservation easements acquired within a forest legacy area. That's language that's been in the bill for the last several years, but the DNR asked that it be deleted. The amendment to page 29, lines 12 and 13, corrects the name of the Mille Lacs County landfill, which will be cleaned up with the proceeds of closed landfill revenue bonds. I should note that on that, I think we need one little addition to that. On page 29, line 11 at the end of the line, to delete the. The amendment to page 32, deleting lines 18 to 21, deletes an exemption from certain requirements imposed on a watershed district when it constructs an improvement project. Since the improvements to the Lake Titlow watershed will be constructed by the City of Gaylord, not by a watershed district. Amendment to page 43, line 4, says that Hennepin and Ramsey counties need not spend their matching money for this project at a rate faster than dollar for dollar with the money from the state appropriation. The amendment to page 49, line 24, authorizes the early childhood learning and childhood protection facilities grants to be used for construction as well as for rehabilitation of facilities. The amendment to pages 50 and 51 delete a requirement that the federal money received be credited to the state bond fund. This is federal money for construction of additional nursing facilities at the Minnesota Veterans Home in Minneapolis. Since the appropriation is only for the state share, not for both the state and federal share. If we were appropriating 100% of the money, then when the federal money came back, the federal money would go into the bond fund to pay off the bonds that the state had sold. But we've reduced the amount of the state appropriation, so we're only appropriating the 35% state share. So when the federal money comes in, it needs to be spent out of the federal fund, not put into the bond fund. The amendment to page 60, lines 28 to 30, increases from $30,000 to $100,000 the amount of a grant to renovate the historic Wells Crane Depot. It authorizes the money to be spent for renovation rather than for pre-design of renovation and eliminates the match requirement, the usual equal match. The amendment to page 86, line 16, corrects the name of Winona State University.
Okay, members have the A3 amendment in front of us. Has everybody reviewed the amendment as Mr. Watson was discussing it? Further questions about the amendment?
Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Watson, the deletion of siphons at Canisteo Pit does not mean that they can't use siphoning. It just does, it gives them a broader range of options. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, I believe that's true, and I'm looking for Mr. Yes, the DNR shakes their head, yes.
Okay. Is there further discussion on the amendment? Senator Paris.
Mr. Chairman, I just have a question about whether or not the amendment changes the arrangement of the other non-stated dollar figures affiliated or set forth in this bill.
No, I don't believe so. That going from $30,000 to $100,000, that just comes out of the local grants from the Historical Society. So it doesn't change anything. It just designates that 10% of that would go for
it. Mr. Mossman?
That particular part of the state got nothing. Hmm. And a big, big hole there. And we tried to kind of figure out ways, and there was a request on this museum, so we would like to designate $100,000 of that local grant.
Thank you.
Mr. Mossman, is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Parisot, Senator Langseth, yes, I believe that that is correct. There, it doesn't change any of the general fund obligations or bond obligations.
Okay, further questions on the A3 amendment? Anybody wish to move the amendment? Okay, Senator Ferguson moves adoption of the A3 amendment. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Senator Langseth, do you have other amendments?
Yeah, I do. But I would like to just mention one thing. There was this project in our township we funded 2 years ago. They were in the process of negotiating this one land purchase at the time I put the bill together. We had had something in there, and then I decided to wait. The next day in the paper, it mentioned that they had come to an agreement, and I guess the state share for the acquisition would be $3 million. Now, I believe that they would be eligible under the, what we call the WMAs, or Wildlife Management Area. So in the future now, I think, in conference committee and so on, we certainly would consider funding that project, because I think that's probably a very high priority project, and it's all, the funding has all been put together with one exception, and that is the $3 million from the state. So while it isn't in here, I think we certainly could make accommodation for that in the future. It looks like the timing is right now.
And do you have any further amendments that you wanted to offer?
Oh, yeah, it deletes that funding for the Lake Vermilion Park.
A4.
Okay, the A4 amendment. If that remained in there, I was told that it would be pulled into another committee. It doesn't eliminate this project. It's simply, well, take another course, I guess. So whether you're for or against that project, this isn't saying that we're against it. It's just that that one committee thought we were overstepping our bounds when we come up with this particular creative funding, which they had voted against, I guess, in LCMR. But that will be, I expect, will still be discussed in another legislation.
Okay, let's wait till the amendment's distributed.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Langseth, I appreciate your taking that out. I don't think it's even constitutional to take it directly from the trust fund. But I thought you might want to just, as long as you've already got $30 million off budget, you could just put this in general fund dollars as a placeholder.
No, let's not do that.
I think for now we will take it out. The governor mentioned that when I talked to him. He's interested in that project. I think that project is not dead. It's just that how it's funded or whether it's funded will be done someplace besides my bill. I was asked to put it in as a placeholder, but the person who asked me to put it in said, go ahead, remove it. So.
On the other hand, Senator Anderson, if you'd like to volunteer another $100,000 from your budget, we could certainly do that.
Mr. Chair, that does raise a question that I was going to ask about this cash, but I'll wait till we're done voting on the amendment, perhaps.
Hey, Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to comment about the do
pair it maybe with a direct appropriation from the Environmental Trust Fund sometime in the future, and maybe with cash or bond from the state. So I don't want you to think that our commission's evaluation of this project meant we were against establishing a park. It's just the way that it's proposed.
Okay, thanks.
Well, and Mr. Chair, by voting for this amendment, I also want to be clear that we're, as Senator Langseth said, we're not saying this project is dead. We're hoping that it can live to see another day in a different form, correct?
Correct.
Okay, we have the A4 amendment in front of us as presented by Senator Langseth. Does somebody wish to move the amendment? Senator Tomasoni moves adoption of the A4 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Senator Langseth, do you have any further amendments?
There's an A13 amendment. I guess Peter would have to explain that.
Mr. Chairman, as the amendment is being passed out, this is one that was requested by the Department of Finance to incorporate in the bill some changes to the governor's bonding recommendations that arose after the governor's bill for capital investment was introduced and finalized. The first part of it has to do with the federal grant for the Urban Partnership Agreement. The Department of Transportation expects that they will indeed enter into an agreement and will get $47.4 million from the federal government for that project. That money will go into the Trunk Highway Fund, but it can't be spent unless the money is appropriated by the legislature out of the Trunk Highway Fund, or there is approval through the Transportation Contingent Appropriation Group, which was meeting last fall on the 35W bridge appropriations. So this just appropriates the federal money out of the Trunk Highway Fund. The reason you see the $9 million general fund number in there is because it's already in the bill, and this takes that subdivision and converts it from a single appropriation into two appropriations. The second part of the amendment to page 84, line 17, authorizes money that was appropriated, I think it was 2006, for the Cedar Lake Trail to be used also for land acquisition in addition to being used for construction of the trail. Apparently that is something that needs to be done there. And the change to page 85, the effective date, makes the change related to Cedar Lake effective retroactively from June 2nd, 2006. That's the date when the 2006 capital investment bill became effective, and perhaps when they started spending the money to acquire land for the Cedar Lake Trail.
All right, we have the A13 amendment in front of us. Are there further questions from the committee? Anybody wish to move the amendment?
So moved.
Senator Pariseau moves adoption of the A13 amendment. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Senator Langseth, any?
That's it for
okay.
Our amendments.
Any other? Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, I have the A7 amendment. I move the adoption of the A7 amendment. Mr. Chairman, members, it's a simple amendment, and I'll describe it as it's being distributed. There's $33,900,000 in the bill for flood control, and there is a list of flood control projects that would be eligible for this money. When we were putting the bill together, I overlooked that we did not include one flood control effort in the bill, and that's in the Minnesota River watershed, and it's area 2 of the Minnesota River Basin. We have appropriated money for area 2 for every bonding bill for the past 20, 25 years. And this would simply make area 2 of the Minnesota River Basin for flood control purposes eligible for some of that $33,900,000. And over the years, we've typically had about $500,000 in these bills.
Mr. Chairman, we have funded this in the past, and I have no problem with that. It won't be designating, I don't think yours designates an amount. It just puts them on the list so that the department can fund it. So I have no problem with it.
We have Senator Ferguson's motion in front of us. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Further amendments. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, I have the A-12 or A-11. Well, I have the A-11 and the A-12. You can pass them both out as long as people are wandering. And, Mr. Chair and members, they're both on page 55 of the bill. The A-11 amendment, I have an oral amendment to the amendment when that comes. So maybe I'll talk about the A-12 first. The A-12 amendment is for the redevelopment accounts, and we seem to have a focus this year on making sure that all of the projects are ready to go. And so this would say that the grants would be returned if construction didn't start on those projects funded by the redevelopment account within 120 days of the grant agreement being signed.
Mr. Chairman, I was aware of this amendment. I think it's okay.
Does this go to? She's on 12, isn't she? Same page.
We're having both amendments distributed of Senator Higgins, but we're dealing now. She has moved the A-12 amendment.
So it was after line 33. Okay. It's down at the bottom of the page.
Thank you.
It's reading that one. I haven't got that.
What deal is this? What deal is this?
Senator Langseth?
Yeah. I'll accept it.
Okay, I think that was Alex.
I think he said I'll accept it.
Okay. Further discussion on the A-12 amendment? Does everybody have it? If no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Senator Higgins.
And Mr. Chair, on the A-11 amendment, I'd like to make an oral amendment to remove no more than and just start the amendment at one-third. And this is an amendment that would take a third of the appropriation in the bill for the biosciences projects for the University Research Park. For the public infrastructure part of that project.
The bioscience is a divided metro room, but it's okay.
Okay. In talking to the people from advocating for the rural areas, they're okay with this.
Okay. Can you explain the amendment again, Senator Higgins?
Mr. Chair, my oral amendment is to delete the first three words.
I understand that.
Okay. The amendment then would take one-third of the appropriation for the bioscience business development public infrastructure grant program, and it would be for the project that's called the University Research Park. It's it is in the designated biosciences zone, and it's right there next to the university. And if you want more information, somebody can come and give you more than that, I know.
Okay. Senator Langseth?
Yeah, I'm okay with it.
So this doesn't change the appropriation. It simply restructures the appropriation in the bill. And is there any opposition to this from either side of the of what's represented?
Not that I know.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Sarah.
Thank you. When it says it's to support a private research park, are we permitted to use these bonding dollars for private research park?
No, yeah.
Public infrastructure.
Well, Sir,
I understand it's for infrastructure, public infrastructure.
It's the public infrastructure part.
Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Higgins, I don't see why you removed the first three words there. Now you're being very precise exactly one-third of this appropriation must be for public infrastructure. Why would you want to be that precise when you have the words no more than? You've got some flexibility there so that maybe if it's if less is spent, that what's the problem with spending less than a third?
Mr. Chair, Senator DeDill, that mean that it would possibly get nothing. If it's no more than a third, it could be less than a third or nothing.
What if you don't need more than a third?
Mr. Chair, Senator DeDill, it's a fairly hefty project, so I know that the infrastructure part of that would be at least the one-third that's available, and probably more, but we're asking for this much.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Diggins, where is this located?
This is next to the University of Minnesota. I want to say along 280. Can somebody help me out? Yes, along 280.
Right. We have the Higgins Amendment in front of us, Senator Frederickson.
Mr. Chairman, I was puzzling over the one-third amount, too, as apparently Senator Dill was, and I'm wondering why we don't say $3,250,000 or $3,500,000 so it comes out to an even amount for which they're eligible.
We could do that. That would make people feel better.
Well, Senator Frederickson, do you want to amend the proposed amendment?
I will. I'll suggest to Senator Higgins maybe she make it $3,500,000.
Mr. Chair, I move that.
All right. So, does the amendment then read 3.5 million of this appropriation?
Yes.
All right. And so, Senator Higgins incorporates that into her amendment, the A11 amendment. Is there further discussion on the amendment? Okay. If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries.
Thank you.
Further amendments on the part of the committee.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stump.
I have A16.
Thank you.
We have the amendment distributed. Senator Stumpf.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, in the Capital Investment Committee, we had discussion about the Biomedical Science Research Facilities Program, and it wasn't clear at that time exactly how it was all going to work in terms of the sale of the bonds What this amendment does is it clarifies, I think, the intent of what both the university wanted, as well as clarifies it so that when you read the intent of the legislation, it has, you know, it has, it does what we want it to do. And I believe the University of Minnesota is fine with that. Mr. Watson, who drafted, Senate counsel who drafted that, I think, say that it all works.
Okay. Senator Stumpf, as I'm looking at the amendment, I don't think there's a problem. Senator Langseth, have you had a chance to look at this?
I think it's just clarifying what the intent was.
Is there anybody here from the university who can just verify that? Okay. Mr. Fitzenreiter says it looks okay. All right, we have Senator Stumpf's A6 amendment in front of us. Is there further discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed. Motion carries. Further amendments from the committee. Senator Stumpf.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have another amendment, but I do have an issue that we brought up which hasn't been totally resolved, and it has to do with the energy efficiency of buildings that the state of Minnesota helps fund. And we found out in the Capital Investment Committee that the University of Minnesota was not covered under energy efficient type buildings. The Minsky facilities were not covered, and only a small handful of other facilities, local buildings were not covered, local governmental jurisdictions were not covered. So it was only the direct state buildings that were covered. And I think just so that everybody maybe thinks a little bit about this, when we're in such a critical energy shortage, we should be trying to cover as many of those facilities and make them energy efficient and self-sustaining and as much as possible. But again, I don't have an amendment. I just wanted to bring that point up.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I think this is something that probably a policy committee has got to look at very carefully over the next couple of years. We've got to make sure we do this right. I remember when many of our school buildings were built back in the 70s and 80s when energy was a big deal, they made them too tight. And the air quality in those buildings was very, very bad, and many of the children were getting sick. So I think there are many different ways this can be done, but I would be hesitant to put any kind of mandate on now, and I know you're not doing that now, but I think we should really look at it in the future. There's some of these things that have very good payback, I guess within 5 years or something like that. And as long as it's done properly, it doesn't affect air quality, I think that's a good idea. But I really do think that a particular committee, probably the Higher Education Committee, well, that would just take care of part of it. But we should take a very good look at this and just see what the technology is and so on for the future.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I wasn't aware that, I tried to meet with Minsky the other day to talk about it, and I had to cancel the meeting, but I wasn't aware they were specifically exempted from that requirement. And, you know, that requirement was put into law and has already been implemented in some building projects. And we had a report on this in the Energy Committee about how successful it's been. It's already saved the state millions of dollars in energy costs, that requirement for high energy efficiency standards for all buildings paid for with state bonds. And so I agree with Senator Stumpf that everybody needs to be in that game, and we shouldn't be excluding university buildings. There's no reason to do that. And, you know, Senator Langseth, you're right that some mistakes have been made in the name of tightening energy codes, but I think we've moved beyond that because it's really not a problem of houses being better insulated and using less energy. It is not what's causing mold problems. It's, you know, how you design ventilation and moisture, and you can fix those problems and still have a state-of-the-art building that uses less energy. And that's what I know some of the university and Minsky buildings have used firms that incorporate really strong energy saving standards, and we should require that of every building paid for with state dollars. So I'm a little surprised to hear of this, and I think we should incorporate that in this bill. I don't have an amendment either, but I wasn't aware of the problem.
Mr. Chairman, I think probably the problem there is that it takes more upfront money to build this into these structures, and I'm not quite sure how it would work, whether this extra money that it would cost up front would then have to come out of, I expect, the rest of their proposal and maybe cause some problems. So I guess I would be hesitant to put it in now. I think this is something we can certainly be talking about between now and the time the bill goes to the governor, but try to figure out. I'm just a little concerned that if it costs a fair amount of upfront money, that we haven't adequately come up with that in these proposals.
Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, after the Capital Bonding Committee meeting, we discussed this.
I just had brief conversations with the university in Minsky. The university said they do follow the sustainable building guidelines now, but we just weren't clear. We thought there was strong interest and efforts at energy efficiency. Of course, all of HEPRA is really energy efficiency. So I think we just need to have some more conversations with them.
Okay. Further discussion or amendments? Senator Stumpf, if you could. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Langseth, I was just noting that the Bell Museum appears twice, one at the University of Minnesota and one in DNR. And you funded the university request, but not the DNR. What was the DNR one for?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, that was really enhancement of the grounds around the structure, and it was felt that the important thing now is to get the building up. Those enhancements can come later.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Stumpf, if you could, Chair, I've got a couple of amendments to offer.
Peter?
Okay.
That's the same thing.
All right, let's take Senator Murphy first. Senator Murphy.
Oh, she's off right now. Yes. Oh, I thought you were just giving it to her. She's from St. Paul. That's okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Sir Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and members, this is actually, I really don't have a dog in this fight other than this is a grant to the city of Bayport for $150,000, and it's to help extend the sewer system from the DNR pond. It's a project that is needed, as you see on page 3, down there on lines 31 through 33. All this does is it doesn't cancel the money so that project can keep going forward.
That cancellation wasn't in the cancellation.
Mr. Watson.
Mr. Chairman, just a correction. The language on page 3, lines 31 to 33, extends the appropriation of $1.55 million from 2005 for this project. That's an extension of the current appropriation. Mm-hmm. But the language on page 1, the $150,000 on line 3, that is a breakout of money that's appropriated from the wastewater infrastructure fund for a variety of projects. So it's not additional money in the bill, but it is specifying that some of the money that's appropriated be used to finish this Bayport project that was started back in 2005.
So, Senator Langseth, Mr. Jensen, is this a cancellation?
Mr. Chair, I believe there is a change because of the language in the first line, the $150,000 designated from, that's different, isn't it, from what is in present law?
Yes.
I'm a little confused by that.
Yes.
So it is an additional $150,000.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Langseth, it's an additional $150,000 for this project, but it's not additional money in the bill because it's taking money that's already appropriated in the bill and specifying that part of it be used for this project. Yeah. And this language was in the bill a year ago.
Senator Langseth?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I'm okay with it.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question about how this amendment relates to paragraph A on page 54. Is the city of Bayport an eligible municipality under the wastewater infrastructure program? And my concern is that we're not appropriating more money on these subsections that are in the section.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fredrickson, if you take a look at page 54, on line 54.4, you'll see the total appropriation of $10,300,000 for the wastewater infrastructure funding program. $300,000 of that is from the general fund to implement the program. That's on lines 11 to 13.
That's up to you.
The balance, the $10 million, is for grants. Paragraph B, starting on line 29, breaks out some money out of that $10 million for grants for which these municipalities would not otherwise be eligible. They would not be on the priority list and priority order, so they wouldn't qualify. But there is the $2 million for corrective action on various projects that were first authorized in 2005, and then there would be this $150,000 for the Bayport project.
Thank you.
I think Mr. Coleman was going to make a comment. He's in charge of this.
Mr. Chairman, I'd withdraw the amendment. Thank you.
I think the extension is fine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Senator Murphy has withdrawn his amendment.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, we'll get it fixed up and
do it next.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Thank you, Senator Murphy. Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lang said you and I have talked about the need for more wastewater infrastructure funding, and there's, like, on this line here on page 54, line 54.3, there's $10.3 million listed there, which you and I have both discussed is not enough. Is there any way, where can we find more money to add to that?
Take it out of the till, I guess. No, I don't know. We're matching the federal, which is quite generous as far as the match. Once we go beyond that, then it's totally state money. Now, having said that, you are certainly right. There was 86 separate requests. And obviously, it isn't going to cover anywhere near that. But I don't know. I guess we're going to have to figure out in the future just where we can come up with additional money. It seemed like we, on some of these things, come up with creative financing for some of this. I'm not sure, but we did just go with the match of the federal. And I'm sure we could throw another $50, $100 million of state money in this, and it would all be spent very well. But I think over the next couple of years, we're going to have to figure out how we can do a much better job of this in the future.
Okay, and then Senator Stumpf, can I ask you to chair? Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, I've got a couple of amendments I'd like to offer. The first is the A-10 amendment. Members, Mr. Chairman, as this is being distributed, let me just offer a couple of comments, and we've got some people here who can testify to the amendment. Senator Langseth, this is the housing amendment. And members, this was an amendment that I was going to offer in Senator Langseth's committee, which I believe, Senator Langseth, you did not have any objection to, but we were starting to run out of time. I needed to just check one thing relative to it, so we decided I'd offer it in this committee. And Senator Langseth, I believe that you're okay with the amendment. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Now, members, what it does is it's a proposal for the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency that provides for bonding authority for the issuance of housing, particularly for homelessness. I think this probably makes this amendment would be the major effort in this bill relative to homelessness. And I know Mr. Epson has worked on this, and I'm not sure who's here from Housing Finance. I don't think Ms. Orr is here. But, Senator Langseth, would you like to have a little bit of testimony from members of the committee?
That's fine. That's fine.
Okay, so do we...
Senator Cohen, we do have somebody here.
Let's see.
So, Mr. Chairman, again, Senator Langseth and I have discussed this, have gone through it, but for members of the committee.
Okay. Please give your name for the record.
I'm Jeanette Blankenship with Housing Finance Agency. And do you just want me to go over the bill?
Mr. Chairman, if you could just offer a couple of minutes on what the agency is attempting to do and how it matches with this bill.
Certainly. This is basically, in the past, we've had supportive housing that when using bonding money has to be publicly owned. It's added cost to the construction because that's a standalone. So this would allow nonprofits to actually own or to develop and own the supportive housing. This does complete our long-term housing or our long-term homelessness business plan, which is our last kind of only request. This is for $30 million, and it would be no appropriation is needed this year. It actually wouldn't start until 2010. And it's similar to the University of Minnesota Stadium and how that was constructed.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Langseth.
Mr. Chair, yeah, we've Senator discussed Langseth. This, and it's fine with me.
Mr. Chairman, I would move the amendment.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen, page 2, line 3. What is an insubstantial portion? One of you should have a percent in there. Or term?
Senator Cohen.
Okay, I can spell it. Okay.
Please explain.
This is, we've consulted with the rating agencies for the past couple of years in creating this, and it's actually kind of a term of art, as I understand it, for the bonding, for those making the bonds. And as I understand it, it's basically less than 5%. But it's a term of art, what I understand.
Okay. Senator Fredrickson?
Senator Cohen, maybe we should put a definition in the definition section as to what that amount is less than 5%?
Mr. Watson?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Fredrickson, I think I'd discourage that. If it's a term of art, it probably comes from the IRS regulations and maybe the Internal Revenue Code. And as the witness has indicated, it's well understood in the bond community.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson?
If you don't want to make a definition, could you not just say less than 5% of the bond proceeds may be used for that purpose rather than using the word? Does that circumvent the term of art? If it carries the spirit of it, it certainly is clearer.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
I'm not unsympathetic. I'd be a little bit hesitant, though, where we're getting into an area that we're a little bit uncertain. My preference, Senator Olson, would be to defer to the agency and to Mr. Watson in terms of their understanding of, as it has been phrased, the term of art in this instance. I'd be hesitant, without knowing a little bit more, to change what the agency has worked on.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, we're making a rather substantial change here in that we're paying for things for nonprofits to own in relation to this, and that's a new direction.
Do you want to respond?
Chairman, I apologize. I didn't follow all that. But we would prefer that it would stay insubstantial because that's been recommended by the our bond council.
Okay. Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, I was curious what insubstantial amount was, and I'm very satisfied with the explanation as long as the term of art and the people in this that work in this area understand what it is.
Okay, Senator Cohen moves the A-10 amendment. Senator Vickerman.
Mr. Chair, I work very hard for veterans, and there are homeless veterans. I hate to say that, but there are some. Would they qualify under this too then, Senator Cohen?
Mr. Chairman, the amendment does not limit the utilization of the bonds, whether it's for veterans or other homeless programs.
Mr.
Chairman.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering on line 1.25, it talks about permanent supportive housing, and it means housing that is not time limited. And I'm wondering if that means that when people reach a certain level of financial stability, that there's no requirement for them to move out and open up those spaces for other people who may be homeless.
Please.
Chairman, Senator Roebling, we do find that when people are kind of self-sufficient, they often do move out. So there is no, you know, set amount of time. But we do find that typically when they're up and ready to go, they do prefer to move out and get their own accommodations.
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
I'm just aware that there's a lot of people waiting for, you know, some form of subsidized housing, and I'm thinking that at some point we should, you know, encourage people to leave so others can move in and that list can be reduced. I'm on the commission to end poverty, and we're going to be talking about this issue as well, probably, because there is a long waiting list for housing. And once people are established, I would think that maybe we could give them some assistance to find other housing, but not continue to leave them in the subsidized facilities.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Cohen, is this a type of revenue bond, or maybe you could just explain to me how these bonds will be financed?
Mr. Chairman, there's a future appropriation, subsequent appropriation, as was indicated, not dissimilar from the Gopher Football Stadium, which we passed 2 years ago to house football players. This is to house other people.
So, Mr. Chairman and Senator
Cohen, Berlin.
So we're making a general fund commitment in the future. When does this start?
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, the next biennium, not this biennium.
Senator Pierce.
Mr. Chairman, I'm very sympathetic to this cause, but I'm very nervous about spending money we don't know whether we'll have.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Berglund, normally I share that as indicated by earlier comments, but this, in my discussions with Senator Langseth, this seemed to be the way to provide some housing support, which historically Senator Langseth has done in his bonding bills. And this seemed to be a good way, and under the circumstances, maybe the only way to do it. Senator Langseth, I don't know if you'd agree with that, but
Mr. Chair, this is also a governor's proposal, and I understand that it is going to be on a future bonding supplemental proposal of his. You know, one of the problems with the GO bond in the state is we have to go with the state standards, which makes the buildings a lot more expensive. Under this situation, the standards wouldn't have to be quite as high. Doesn't mean those buildings won't be safe. They certainly will be. But that, I think one of the reasons that they wanted to do this was because they could get more facilities for their money.
Senator Parasol.
I think, Mr. Chairman, I was going to ask Senator Cohen, or maybe it should go to Senator Langseth. Is this taking bonding in a new direction from the standpoint that then the ownership of the buildings will be in nonprofit hands rather than governmental hands? It seems to me that I can't recall how many projects we've had, because I've never served on your committee, so I'm not sure whether that has ever been done before.
Chairman, Senator Pariseau.
I mean, I'm really interested in seeing some homeless shelters out there. I mean, shelters and housing out there. But this is, if this is a new turn, I think we have to look at it pretty heavily.
This will actually, so in the past, yes, we've used GO bonds for supportive housing. And it has created a lot of hurdles. It's not necessarily the standard that the building is created at. It's that it has to stand alone. And much of our supportive housing is integrated into other affordable housing developments. Therefore, anything created with GO bond money has to stand alone. And there, if part of the building that was financed with other financing something should happen to it. You know, the heating has to be separate. You have to create extra elevators. We have an example with that Lutheran Social Services, a recent building constructed with that, added a whole lot of cost because the nonprofit was developing it but was using geo bonds, and part of it had to be publicly owned. So this will actually make it more affordable to develop supportive housing. And, yes, the nonprofit would be the owner of it instead of a local unit of government or municipality.
Senator Pearsall?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Cohen or Senator Langseth, have you ever done any other nonprofit purposes, such as medical clinics or different kinds of services that would be equally needy in the past?
Senator,
anything like that?
There, Senator Langseth. We funded the Children's Hospital and passed Bonnie Bells, and I can't quite remember how that was. I know there was a problem being that was a private or a nonprofit. But I do remember that was a, and I don't know exactly how we did that.
Okay, Senator Cohen moves the A-10 amendment. Any further discussion or questions? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Oppose the same sign?
No.
Motion is adopted.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
I have another amendment. If members would allow me to move this on an oral basis, it's not prepared. But this is relative to what Senator Langseth mentioned. Members on the bill, page 41, subdivision 2, part A. This is the $4 million for the urban partnership agreement, which Senator Langseth has pointed out is carried in the transportation bill, which has now become law. So my amendment would move deletion of Section A, lines 19 through 24, 4119 to 4124, and renumbering of the subsequent sections. And, Mr. Chairman, as members will remember from a few minutes ago, this is the discussion Senator Langseth and I had about general fund dollars in the bill. This is a general fund appropriation covered in the bill we've already passed, and it's become law. So I'd make that motion, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Cohen moves on page 41, delete subdivision 2.
No. Mr. Chairman, I was wondering if Senator Cohen would lay this aside for a few minutes. There's a problem with some dates here and releasing money early enough so that
fine.
This can happen.
Okay.
Okay, I'd withdraw the amendment then.
Senator Cohen withdraws the amendment.
Okay, I know we're going to start running out. Senator Murphy?
Mr. Chairman, back to the A5 amendment that I offered earlier. The only portion of that amendment that needs to become law is on page 3, lines 31 through 33. We don't need that first page, Mr. Chairman. All we need is the authority to continue this money forward.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Watson.
And I think that's what Senator Langseth was inkling at earlier.
No. Mr. Chair, this is fine. It's what I understood was intended. So.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Watson.
To accomplish that, we would just delete lines 1.2 to 1.17 of the amendment.
Senator Murphy?
Mr. Chairman, I would make that correction and then move the A5 amendment as amended.
We have Senator Murphy's motion on the A5 amendment as amended. Further discussion? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Motion carries. Do we have the same?
Yes.
Any more mess?
Senator, we have a couple more minutes left, a couple more amendments, and I noticed Commissioner Hansen and Dr. Stinson just walked in. Senator Pappas?
The A15.
Okay, we have the A15 amendment.
What?
too many trees in there, Mr. Chairman.
Sorry about that. On 1.7.
Oh. Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, this is a very unfortunate amendment. It's like, you know, cutting off the arms of each of your children to feed another child. St. Paul's in a very difficult situation with having to pay the debt service on the River Center Convention Center. And we basically need to have something in the bonding bill. And we had a number of things that were considered in St. Paul's column, and we decided to just take a little bit of money from several of them. So this will fund the River Center debt service at $3.5 million. So, Mr. Watson, I don't know what that extra three is there for. Just a typo?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pappas, that's a stray three. That first three
stray
should not
three.
Be there.
So we'll eliminate the stray
three. Can't do
three.
$33 million.
I think it's $303 million.
The request
we'll
was.
That. Yeah.
Well, there was a zero in there.
Oh yeah, put a zero in. The request was actually $43 million for this project. So you know, I'm very reluctant to do this, but this is what we have to do. So we're taking $1 million from the St. Paul College, $1 million from Como Park, $1 million from Capital Restoration, and $500,000 from the Asian Pacific Cultural Center in order to pay for this, the first year of debt service on the River Center.
Is that your Capital Restoration money?
Okay. Senator Betzel.
Well, Mr. Chair, the, you know, the, as for the Capital Restoration, you know, this is one of the most beautiful buildings in the state from the outside. If you go in the underbelly, you go into the non-public areas, this place is rotting. It's falling apart. I know Senator Langseth has been very supportive of trying to do something. I haven't seen as much interest from the governor or from the House. The governor did recommend some emergency money. I'm not even sure where the House is these days. But at some point, and it, you know, we are absolutely failing in our fiduciary responsibility to keep this building up to date. All you need to do is go on the third floor, look at some of the damage that's being done there. It's falling apart, and we are to blame that. Now, pulling money here and there is just, you know, fine. You know, that's you know, how we make things balance. But I'm losing patience for the fact that, you know, damage that's being done to this building on our watch, and nobody seems to care in this building, and that's a shame.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have to, you know, as a senator from St. Paul, living in St. Paul, we've had a lot of discussions about the difficult straits that our city is in, and financially, and so I have to reluctantly support this amendment. Based on the need that we have to put something in place to deal with this this debt service problem. You know, I'm like a broken record about Como Park. I think my colleagues know nobody. It's near and dear to my heart, and I think all of these projects are critically important and have an amazing amount of statewide benefit that they will bring. So I'm going to support this amendment, but I just want to say that I think that we need to do this today to put a place in this bill for this important River Center issue in St. Paul. I'm really hopeful that Senator Langseth can help us in the conference committee to make sure that we get the adequate level of funding for all of these projects that we need. I know it's a really difficult task that he has. So just wanted to say that.
And if members will allow, I'll make a couple of comments because I certainly hope and expect this amendment's going to carry. Senator Betzold, I happen to agree with you. And certainly the Capital Restoration has been a little bit of an orphan, absent support of people like yourself and Senator Rest. Probably the entirety of the state legislature, not just simply the Senate. But, you know, between the entities of the governor, the House, the Senate, it's probably the two of you who have done the heavy lifting relative to the issue. And certainly we do have, as you suggest, a fiduciary duty. Unfortunately, the St. Paul Senators have a fiduciary duty to the city of St. Paul. And Senator Langseth and I have had numerous conversations about this. I think part of the problem we have is that St. Paul, and this isn't necessarily, I don't want to get too far in detail, but in some of the discussions within among St. Paul legislators as well as the city, I don't think we conveyed to Senator Langseth as effectively as we should have the highest priority of this proposal. But certainly, if you look at Senator Langseth's bill, the present bill in front of us, if you look at past actions of this legislature, I wish we could rewrite history. When St. Paul had its original proposal for the River Center, Senator Pappas was the author of the sales tax. We assumed at that time that that would be sufficient. It is not. Minneapolis was many steps ahead of us when 4 years later, Minneapolis secured $80 million from the state legislature for construction of its convention center, coupled with the usage of local option taxes. And now we have other cities. Senator Langseth, you have expressed the concern, and understand that, relative to how many event centers, convention centers, whatever do. And obviously we have Duluth in this year's bill. We have other proposals in front of the legislature, I think within this bill as well. We have the precedent set by the city of Minneapolis. St. Paul's situation, for a variety of reasons, has become quite dire. And as Senator Pappas pointed out, and that was accentuated by Senator Betzold, although I'm not sure, Senator Pappas, of your metaphor, I think that was a little bit about taking arms of children, feeding them. But separate from the use of metaphors, certainly Senator Pappas's comments were well taken, that we're not happy as a St. Paul delegation to do this, but we have no choice, and hope that members would support our amendment. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm glad to see that you're taking some money off of some other St. Paul projects, but I do not consider the state capitol a St. Paul project. I consider that a project for the entire state of Minnesota. And so, therefore, Mr. Chair, for the sake of discussion right now, I would like to eliminate line 1.3, and on line 1.5, change $6.5 million for the Asian Pacific Cultural Center to $5.5 million. And the reason I'm choosing that project is ever since it was introduced, I have been skeptical about the precedent that this particular project establishes in constructing cultural centers for a specific culture. And the onslaught of requests we may have from other cultures that would like to have something similar to that. And so I really don't – I think we should be taking money from the state capital project. I mean, there was 53 million requested or 58 million requested for the first phase of the capital restoration, and we're already down to 15.4, and I think that is really pathetic, quite frankly. And we just have to set our priorities here, and I think the state capital is something that we need to maintain, and this is simply maintenance, before we start building cultural centers with state dollars.
Well, Senator Roebling, certainly we would oppose that your amendment and hope it would fail. I happen to agree. Well, first of all, I disagree relative to the Asian Pacific Center. Second, is the Capitol building a statewide facility as opposed to a St. Paul facility? We've had numerous discussions with Senator Langseth as to how St. Paul monies were put together, and in fact, we've moved away from other parts of the amendment for that reason. But I think what's happened is in many places in this bill, we're looking at zip codes, and 55155 is in St. Paul. And if that's kind of a new standard we're setting, then we don't have a choice. So I understand your point. Hope members will oppose the amendment. Is there further discussion on the Roebling Amendment? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
No.
Motion fails.
Division.
Division. All those in favor of the amendment signify by raising your hand. All those opposed to the amendment? Usually I hear pretty well, but apparently not on that one. All right. Further discussion on Senator Pappas's amendment. I said the motion prevailed.
Senator Cohen.
Senator Stumpf.
Going back to the first one on there, it'd be interesting to hear what $1 million off on the St. Paul College proposal means. I think a lot of these projects are pretty well down the pipeline when they actually get funded, because they've had planning money, they've had design money, and it looks to me like the money that's in there for that college is construction and actually will be put to use for the purposes that are spelled out. So I don't know if there's anybody here from Minsku, but I'd just like to hear what they're going to end up doing on that if they get $1 million less.
Ms. King.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Senator Stumpf, my name is Laura King, and I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities and the Vice Chancellor for Finance and Facilities.
Excuse me, can you pull the mic a little closer? It's hard to hear you.
I'm delighted to be here before you this morning. First of all, to have an opportunity to thank Senator Langseth and the members of the committee for this bill. As the stewards of 25 million square feet of buildings, publicly owned buildings, about a third of the state's buildings, we look to you for very substantial assistance in the care and maintenance of these facilities in order to serve our students. So we're very grateful to Senator Langseth and to the committee. And just to tag on to one other conversation you had earlier in the committee before I address Senator Stump's question, to the question of early bidding, we have provided Senator Stumpf with information that we could have about $80 million in work under contract by July 1st if the bill is closed early and the funds are made available. We work very aggressively to have these projects at the starting line and ready to go the minute funds are available, and so that would be our pledge to you. Senator Stumpf, to your question about this project, this is a 100,000-plus square foot rehabilitation of the lower level of St. Paul College for their trade programs, including auto body repair, automotive technician, diesel truck mechanic, carpentry, pipe fitting, cabinet making, and land surveying. The college has an enrollment. The college has an enrollment of about 3,400 FYE, and about 20% of those students would be using this space, are using it today. About 45% of the college students are students of color, and about 65% are underrepresented students. This is a very high priority population for us, and I think for the legislature as well. This was our fourth priority project on the list this year. We estimate that the $1 million would have either one of two impacts for us. We would either take square footage out of the program in order to make the budget fit and not improve one of the program areas that we have listed here, and we think we'd have to take out a whole program because of the size of the reduction, or we would delay the improvement to the infrastructure. Part of St. Paul College's challenge as the second oldest technical college in the state is a substantial need for air quality, energy efficiency, energy management. So we would have to work with architects and cost estimators to decide which path to take. If we took program out, we think we'd lose about 15,000 square feet, 15 to 20,000 square feet. If we delayed the infrastructure, we probably could count on losing about twice that in square footage because the infrastructure costs are so substantial in this project.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. King, have bids gone out on this, or how do you anticipate given the climate right now, if there's a lot of builders that are hungry, might the bids come in less, or do they tend to use up the money that we appropriate and appears to be available?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, this project we would expect to have in bidding for construction in the third quarter of 2008, so no bids have not gone out yet on this project. And every bidding season is different in terms of the community's response. Some years there's lots of anticipation and lots of downward competitive pressure on the bids. Other years it goes just the opposite. So sitting here and projecting out 7 or 8 months, I'm pretty reluctant to give you an estimate. We have an absolute perfect record of delivering projects on budget. We don't allow projects to go over budget. You have language in this bill that provides for unspent capital appropriations to be recycled at the campus for HEPR projects. So we keep the incentive with the project and the campus. If the proceeds are $100,000 left or $500,000 left, then that language allows the campus to use those dollars for HEPR improvements. We haven't done a lot of that, which suggests to me that these projects are very budget conscious when they get to you. And we work hard to deliver the program that we testified about at the time.
Thank you.
All right. Further discussion. Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman, could you just refresh my memory a little bit more on the history of this, or maybe Senator Pappas can, but is this River-centered debt issue, does that go back to when Senator Coleman was mayor no, it doesn't.
Well,
where does it start?
It started with former Mayor Scheibel and was brought to fruition when Senator Coleman was mayor.
And there was an agreement then that the city would pay the debt service, and they can't do it now, so that's why we're...
Senator Dillon, as is the case with every other population center in the state, that's correct.
Mr. Chairman, how big is the annual debt service, or what percentage of the annual debt service are we providing in this bill?
Well, in Senator Pappas' amendment, it provides for this next year of debt service.
So that's 100% of the debt service for 1 year?
Correct.
Mr. Chairman, along those lines, you know, there's a lot of us around this table that, you know, voted for the XL Center, but paying the debt service wasn't part of the vote that we took back then.
This isn't the XL Center. It has nothing to do with the XL Center.
But it really isn't 100%.
It's, Mr. Chairman, I understand that.
For 3 years.
But when did we start paying the debt service for the XL Center or Riverfront Center, whatever you want to call it? Looks like the same place to me. Yeah.
No, we haven't been. The hockey arena is different from the convention center. They happen to be adjacent to each other, but those were different proposals, different financing mechanisms. You know, this is not just, you know, the hockey arena would be analogous to the 94 legislation for the Target Center, I would argue. This is analogous to the 98 appropriation for the Minneapolis Convention Center. And for the Duluth Center in the bill this year.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask about Duluth.
Pardon, Senator Olson?
Mr. Chairman, I was going to ask how this relates to the Duluth Center.
Well, the difference is Duluth is covered in its entirety. That's how it's different.
It's what?
Duluth is covered in its entirety. That's how it's different.
Mr. Chair, there's a local effort with Duluth.
Half and half.
50%, I believe.
But St. Paul was 100%. So further discussion on Senator Pappas' amendment. Mr. Watson?
Mr. Chairman, in answer to Senator Dill's question about what this amendment picks up, you'll notice that it is only to pay principal. It's not to pay all of the debt service that's due. It's just to pay the principal. The city has to continue to pay the interest on the debt service. And it's not 1 year, it's three. You'll see on line 19, it talks about the payments through November 1, 2010. And on line 9, it talks about paying principal through November 1, 2010. So the state would be making three principal payments on November 1, 2008, 2009, and 2010. And the city would continue to pay interest on the debt through November 1, and that interest totals the $7,160,884 that's shown on line 19.
Now we have to. Okay, further discussion on Senator Pappas' amendment. If there's no further discussion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Further discussion on Senate file, whatever the number is, 3295. And we have Commissioner Hanson and Dr. Stinson, I think, in the hallway to discuss with us how we're going to pay for all this or not pay for it. If there's no further discussion, Senate file 3295. Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I didn't get a chance to ask earlier, but I just want to be clear about the general fund provisions of this bill because, and I apologize, I was about 5 minutes late to the committee, so maybe you talked about this at the beginning. But there's a lot of general fund here that comes from DNR and Bowser, which are obviously part of my committee jurisdiction and or division, excuse me, jurisdiction. I just want to be clear that for all of these general fund appropriations, these are kind of off budget, that you're not going to be sending me a $6 million additional cut that needs to be made out of my division if we vote for this bill today. And, I mean, because these were not – none of these general fund amounts were incorporated into our different division budgets. So I think this – I'm assuming this is sort of taken off the top of the state's overall budget.
Senator Anderson, a very good point, and you might have been out of the room when I made the comments at the outset, that with general fund dollars passing, Senator Murphy's bill, we had $3.6 million. We have the Victims Compensation Fund coming up. We have this the appropriations in this bill. The money's going to come from somewhere. I can't say it's going to come directly from your division versus anybody else's division. It's going to come from somebody's division or a combination thereof. But when we pass bills with free money in it, we got to somehow rework the rest of the budget. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Anderson, this is the part of the bill that I have the most concern about. And, you know, you may not want it to come out of cuts to your division, but nobody wants them to come out of cuts to their division. You know, I'm not anxious. I mean, my share of this would be about $10 million. I don't want to take that out of child care or deaf and hard of hearing services or cut health care eligibility. You know, and so that's the part that's troubling to me is that we have to have this much cash in the bill to start with.
Well, Mr. Chair, and, you know, all of us in our divisions are trying to figure out how to we're going to balance the budget and do our fair share, which we're going to have to do. But these expenditures have not been part of that discussion. And so that's my – I just don't want that to come back later and – hit us in the face. That's my concern.
Can't make a guarantee on that, Senator Anderson. Senator Olson.
But, yeah, I was just a little puzzled that you've got program the Bowser ones, for example, are program administration and project administration. I mean, why are they in the bonding bill anyway? Why wouldn't that have gone? Why wouldn't those things be a part of the discussion of her division instead of Senator Anderson's division instead of being inserted in here?
Senator Olson, as Senator Linkseth indicated earlier, I don't know if you were here or not.
I maybe it wasn't.
Historically, that appropriation has been in a bonding bill. Further discussion on Senate File 3295. If not, does anybody wish to move the bill? Senator Frederickson moves that Senate File 3295 as amended be recommended to pass. Further discussion on that motion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion carries. Okay, members, if people here for the bonding bill are going to leave quietly. And let's bring Commissioner Hanson, Mr. Showalter, and Dr. Stinson up to find out how we're going to pay for the bonding bill. So, Commissioner, thanks for being here. The intent, members, is to have a discussion on the forecast. Obviously, the forecast is puts us in considerable difficulty. So, Commissioner Hanson, and if people can not talk on their way out.
Okay. Commissioner Hansen, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Our goal today is to provide a overview of the forecast, which I will provide, and then Dr. Stinson, our state economist to my right, will give you an update on the national economy, the state economy, and what its impact has been on our anticipated state revenues for the coming biennium and the out biennium. And then to my left is our state budget director, Jim Showalter, will talk about the impact of the forecast on our expected expenditures. We have provided you with a slide presentation that we will work through as we go. On the first chart, you will see that, and as you saw last week when we announced our forecast, that the combined revenue and expenditure and reserve changes leaves us with a state deficit of $935 million for the 2008-2009 biennium. This is $562 million more than we projected in the November forecast. So what's behind some of the numbers? First, the story of this forecast continues to be the worsening national economy and its impact on our anticipated revenues and expenditures. Our macroeconomic consultant, Global Insights, has forecasted a mild short recession for the first two quarters of 2008, the quarter we're in now and then the second quarter as well, and then a bump up from when the federal stimulus package kicks in once consumers get their checks and they go out and do some spending, and then a dip down, and you'll see a chart that Dr. Stinson has that will show this. There's continuing concern about the housing market, energy prices, and the credit crunch, as we discussed in our November forecast as well. Our general fund revenues for 2008-2009 are now forecast to be $32.5 billion. That's $530 million less than in November, and even more significantly, Mr. Chairman, a $1.27 billion drop since our end of session estimates. The primary decline in revenues in this forecast continues to be corporate income tax, which has dropped almost 21% from what we thought was a fairly pessimistic estimate a year ago in February, and in this forecast, a decline in individual income tax, which, if you remember, in November, we had a had an uptick in individual income tax. The general fund spending for this biennium is forecast to be $34.7 billion. Again, not a whole lot of change when you consider the size from our November forecast. We are up $64 million from November and $130 million from last session's estimates. And of that $64, $33 million is a county payment in the human services area that was categorized as a reserve after the legislative session and ended up being spending in December.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, I just have a question about that $33 million. There's some legislation now at the federal level to put a delay on the implementation of those rules, and I'm just wondering if that would happen to pass. Is there a way for us to get the $33 million back?
Mr. Showalter?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I am – the money has gone literally out the door at this point. I think in order to get the money back, we would have to essentially offset it against other payments going to the counties, and we could look into that further. But the money, literally the $33 million, has gone out and been sent to the counties as per the laws of 2007. If we wanted to recapture that as savings, we would probably have to offset that against some other payment.
Okay. Commissioner Hansen.
Mr. Chairman, members, the final point on the second slide is looking at the 2010-2011 biennium. If you remember, we ended our last legislative session in the 10 and 11 projecting a $1.1 billion balance to the good, which exceeded inflation, and we were doing fairly well. with our forecast now shows a shortfall of $1 billion and some change. And when you add inflation, it adds another $1.04 billion. So your total, when you account for inflation, would be about $2.1 billion. That's kind of the overview of the numbers. I will turn it over to Dr. Stinson. We'll give you a little more information on the economy and our anticipated revenues.
Dr. Stinson.
Mr. Chairman, I want to focus your attention on the top table on page 3 of the handout.
Could you move the mic a little closer, too?
Sure.
Thank you.
This table shows what's happened since the since end of session estimates, and really this shows the change in estimates since last February's forecast, because the changes that were made during the session were very small. What you see is that there is a widely dispersed reduction in revenues. It's not just one revenue or two revenue sources dropping, but all of them dropped. Each of them has a slightly different story to tell, however. The individual income tax is $282 million below forecast, or 1.8% below forecast. In November, it actually was up a little bit. The story here is that while employment and wages decline in a recession, employment and wages in this recession don't decline very much from what we already had in the forecast. The place where we have the biggest loss accounts for about 75% of the decline in revenues is in non-wage income, particularly capital gains, dividends, and interest. When there's a recession, corporate earnings typically decline, stock prices typically decline. And that's something that everybody can relate to. What's often forgotten is that in a recession, sales of businesses and sales of commercial property almost dry up, and that there's a bigger shock to the sales of businesses and sales of commercial property than there is actually to the stock market in there. In November, we had no recession in the scenario, so we didn't have that decline in business activity and that decline in commercial property sales. Now we do. We had a 10% increase in capital gains, which is typical of what you have in a normal year, more or less, in November. Now we have a 5% decline. That 5% decline is small compared to what we have often seen in capital gains. If you look at the bottom of page 6, there's a graph that shows what happened to capital gains growth in the most recent recession. There, as many of you probably painfully remember, we had a 45% decline in capital gains in the first year and a 22% decline in the second year. This change is not in capital gains that we have in this forecast is not a very large change in the outlook. We think there are good reasons for that, but we could certainly be wrong, and the risk is that the capital gains could be down a lot more than are in this forecast. On the sales tax, most of the sales tax loss, the $322 million, $309 million of it, we forecast in November, and only $13 million of it since then. There are a couple of reasons for the sales tax not changing any more than it has. First, the Department of Revenue changed their estimate of sales tax refunds. They reduced their estimate of sales tax refunds for 2008-2009 by $35 million. Made the overall outlook a little bit better. Second, the federal stimulus package comes in and actually does stimulate the economy, and the place that it stimulates the economy the most noticeably for us is in the purchases of consumer non-auto durable goods, the key portion of our sales tax base. If you look at the graph on the bottom of page 5 of the handout, you can see the impact of the stimulus package there on this part of the sales tax base. It actually pushes the level of consumer non-auto durable spending above the level forecast in November for two quarters. So that added to the outlook for the sales tax as well and improved the outlook for the sales tax as well. The corporate income tax, the third piece of the story, is something that just seems to have gotten worse and worse. As the commissioner indicated, we told you last February and actually prior to that that we were less optimistic than Global Insight about taxable corporate profits. Turns out that we were not pessimistic enough about the outlook. Our estimated tax payments did not make the level that we forecast between February and November. We lowered the forecast in November. We have since lowered the forecast again. Part of the reason for the change in corporate tax receipts, net corporate tax receipts, is that between the middle of January and the middle of February, a time when we normally don't pay out much in the way of refunds, we paid out more than $50 million in refunds in that period. And so that had to be taken out of the forecast as well. Finally, all other revenues are down $209 million, consistent with just a general weakening of the economy. Overall, since the forecast was done, or end-of-session estimates, revenues are down $1.27 billion, or 3.8%. The growth over 2006-2007 is 0.6% in there. You might have a question as to why the revenues would have fallen that much, and the simple answer is that we're in a recession, or at least that is what is currently part of the Global Insight forecast. We actually won't know for 6 months ago, or 6 months or more probably, whether we're in a recession, but Warren Buffett this morning on CNBC was quoted, actually not was quoted, but said that any reasonable definition of, or by any reasonable definition of a recession, we're in a recession right now, and we've been so. This is not, does not look like it's going to be a deep, hard recession, although we'll see what happens. There's certainly potential downside risk to it. But if things go as is forecast by Global Insight, this is going to be a classic two-quarter negative GDP recession that is both short and mild. If you look at the bottom of page 3, the graph at the bottom of page 3, you see what the forecast is. The first quarter of 2008, we have 0.4% decline in GDP. The second quarter of 2008, we have 0.5% decline in GDP. In November, those numbers were 0.7% growth and 1.6% growth. Then if you look at the next bar, you see the stimulus package coming in, the stimulus package dumping all that money into the economy, both pretty well guarantees that the recession isn't going to extend beyond July, and it provides a huge amount of stimulus in that one quarter. The stimulus then falls back a little bit in the fourth quarter, and there really in this forecast, it's assumed that there is negligible stimulus from the stimulus package at the start of the year. The concern is, and Global Insight reflects this, their forecast, that the stimulus provided by monetary policy, lower interest rates, may not have taken hold quite at the start of 2009. Monetary policy, as you've probably heard me say multiple times in the past, takes somewhere between a year and 18 months to begin to have an effect. And if that is a little slow in getting there, then we could be back down to roughly no growth in the first quarter of 2009 again. If the economy is a little worse than we thought, then we could actually have a double-dip recession where we both drop back down below into negative growth in that period. The sources of the concern about the economy are all familiar to you. It's housing, it's credit, and it's energy. The housing piece is particularly important in Minnesota because not only do we have a significant construction industry, but our lumber and wood products industry serves a national clientele. The real concern in terms of the national economy is the credit situation. What we have is we have the Federal Reserve struggling to keep credit markets liquid so that people can actually borrow to finance inventories, to finance business expansion, to finance the working capital that they need, just the operating expenditures that they need as part of their normal business practices. At this point, credit markets have tightened up enormously. It's much harder to get loans, not just for subprime mortgages and alternative A mortgages, but also for normal business practices. 32% of the senior loan officers as part of the Federal Reserve survey said that they had tightened credit restrictions on commercial industrial loans, general commercial industrial loans. 82% said that they had tightened loans on the commercial industrial real property. The third concern, obviously, is oil prices. In this forecast and in most other major forecasts, oil prices are assumed to drop to an average of about $80 a barrel during the first quarter. That's clearly impossible given how far we are into the quarter by now and the fact that oil prices are $100 a barrel, that you'd have to have just a massive cratering in the oil prices to make $80 a barrel in this quarter. But to $75 a barrel in the next quarter and then to stay at $75 a barrel through the forecast horizon. That set of assumptions is looking less and less realistic. The problem that this creates isn't a huge problem, however. A drop of $10 a barrel, an increase in $10 a barrel from the forecast costs you about 2 to 3 tenths of a percentage point on an annual basis. And so if instead of oil prices being $75 a barrel, they were at $100 a barrel at the end of the year, that doesn't mean that we're suddenly at a 3% decline or anything like that. It means that we take somewhere between 6 tenths and 8 tenths off of the growth rate. But if you flip back and look at the bottom of page 3, the first quarter of 2009 only has a 0.7% growth rate, and so that could easily, the higher oil prices could easily put us into a double-dip recession. The bottom line is that, bottom of page 4, expected real GDP growth in 2008 has fallen in Global Insight's forecast to 1.4%. If you remember back in November, they had a forecast of 1.9% real GDP growth, and they were among the least optimistic of all forecasters. Now they're pretty much right in the middle. The Federal Reserve's range forecast is the bottom part of their forecast is below Global Insight's forecast. For the two quarters, the two negative quarters, Mark Zandi, economy.com, is at 0.3% and 0.3%, Global Insight at -0.4% and -0.5%, Mark at -3% and -0.3% and -0.3%. David Weiss is at -0.5% and -0.7%. Maury Harris of UBS is at -1% and -1.5%. And so you can see that they are no longer an outlier here. The one significant forecaster who has a significantly different forecast you may have read about in the paper on Sunday, Dan Laufenberg, who's a member of our Council of Economic Advisors, he's much more optimistic for 2008, but then 2009, his forecast is for a much more significant recession, and so by the time you get to 2010, 2011, he may actually be a little bit more pessimistic. The top of page 12, I'm sorry, top of page 5, shows you a graph that I've shown you before. This is just the latest incarnation of it. As you remember, what I've told you before is that the way to look at this graph is not the vertical distance between the two lines, but rather the area between the two lines. The area between the two lines shows the national output lost, but it's also kind of a rough proxy for the loss in revenues that goes on as well. The heavy dashed line is the February or the end of session forecast. The lighter dashed line is the November forecast. The heavy solid line is the February 2008 forecast. There are two things that you can see from this. One is you can actually see how the stimulus package moves the line a little bit. It makes it almost, brings it almost back to the November forecast for the third quarter of 2008. The second thing that's obvious is that going on out to 2010 and 2011, we continue to lose money as we extend on out there. One point that I want to make as well on the 2010-2011 is that under current federal tax law, there is an increase in the federal capital gains tax rate in 2011. This means that people realistically are going to look at their finances toward the end of 2010 and say, you know, I'd kind of planned on selling this stock or this item in January or February of 2011, but it's going to cost me 5% more in taxes to do it. And so why don't I just sell it in tax year 2010 and take advantage of the lower tax rate? We think that that's going to cause some acceleration of capital gains realizations. That acceleration, the payments for those realizations will show up in April of 2011, in fiscal 2011, and so that will boost revenues in 2011 on a one-time basis about $327 million for the state. So there's a $327 million one-time boost to revenues in 2011. In 2012, which we don't cover in this forecast or in the planning estimates, but we will next November, the payback comes. And so there's actually a one-time loss then of somewhere on the order of $300 million for fiscal year 2012. So the size of the cliff turns out to be more than $600 million when you add the positive transitory payment and the negative transitory payment that you have there. The final piece that I want to talk just real briefly about is the graph at the top of page 6, and that's the impact of this recession on the housing industry in Minnesota. What you can see from this graph is that we've had a huge decline in the number of housing permits that are issued in Minnesota. For single-family housing permits on a monthly basis, seasonally adjusted, in the fourth quarter of 2005 in Minnesota, it was about 2,400 per month. In the fourth quarter of 2006, it was about 1,200 per month. In the fourth quarter of 2007, we found out after we did the forecast, it was only 800 per month. So it's gone a 50% decline and then a one-third decline from that point as well. So you can see that in the center of this graph, the white bar and then the gray bar, the gray bar was our November forecast. The actual came in noticeably lower than the actual, than the forecast. We've had to revise our forecast down, and we have it recovering kind of at the end of 2009. There's no guarantee that this forecast on the housing side isn't optimistic, and in fact, it probably is optimistic. Mark Zandi from MoodysEconomy.com notes that if we have nationally 900,000 housing starts in 2008, and that's what's forecast, and 900,000, to give you some perspective, is fewer housing starts than we have had in any year since World War II. If we have 900,000 housing starts, if we have zero employment growth, which is what's in the forecast, then in order to work through the inventory that we have so that we would be able to have a pickup in housing activity, housing construction in 2009, it would require a 20% decline in housing prices over this year. That really doesn't seem to me to be likely to occur, and so that means that the slump in the housing industry is likely to be extended out for another 6 months to a year. It's important for Minnesota, as I've said before. In this forecast, we have 13,000 construction jobs being lost during 2008. We have the lumber and wood products industry declining by 2,200 jobs more in addition to the 2,500 jobs that we've already lost. So let me just bring this to a conclusion, Mr. Chairman, and tell you that while we are not unhappy with the forecast that we have now, if we thought we should have been more pessimistic, we would have been more pessimistic. We do believe that there is significant downside risk to this forecast. And the disturbing thing about this downside risk to us that do the forecast is that a lot of it centers on capital gains and the capital gains information that we need really won't be available until near the end of the biennium. We really won't know what's happening with respect to capital gains realizations until we start getting the tax year 2008 tax returns in April of 2009. If we find out that capital gains was weaker than we thought, that doesn't leave very much time to and very much flexibility for balancing the budget. And so that leaves us thinking that concerned about maintaining some reserves in case you get bad news in the last couple of months of the biennium. again, the risk is real. There is a potential upside, although the potential upside, I think, is smaller than the potential downside at this point. With that, if you have any questions, we can take them or we can go on and have Mr. Showalter finish the expenditure side.
Let's have a few minutes for Mr. Showalter and then open up to discussion and questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jim Showalter, State Budget Director, for the record. If you look on the next page, you'll see the next chart is entitled Small Changes in Spending Estimates. That is, in fact, the story on the spending side in this February forecast. Overall, $64 million worth of adjustments on the spending side, $33 million of which was the targeted case management appropriation that was made last session and was spent out of a designated reserve. That is the item that Senator Berglund referenced earlier. So $64 million total change, 33 of which really doesn't affect the bottom line. The remainder is changes in caseload and other factors. In education, a slight uptick and re-estimates of the number of pupil units accounting for much of the change there. And in health and human services, some small increases in the number of persons anticipated to be enrolled in medical assistance, family and children segment, as well as general assistance medical care. Those are two segments that are relatively sensitive to the economy, and we're anticipating some increases there. Those are offset by some declines in the capitation rates for some of the other segments. All in all, relatively little change from the November forecast.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Stinson, let me ask a couple questions, if I might. You've talked about a double-dip recession if it goes into 2009. In the past couple of recessions, what's been the length of time where the economy has been considered to be in recession? How would that compare to the previous recessions?
Mr. Chairman, the last two recessions have lasted, I think, an average of 8.6 months or something like that. So this double-dip recession, depending on how you count it, you'd have 7-8 months. Most people, I think, now are thinking that the recession probably will officially be dated as starting in December and then ending in July. I think that turns out to be 8 months. Then you'd have 6 months of growth. Then the second recession, if it started, would be probably another 3 or 6 months after that. If it's only 3 months, you know, if there's only a one-quarter downturn, then there's a question of whether it'd actually be termed a recession or whether they'd extend it over the entire period. You know, who knows how this would all be worked out once all the data was done. But this would be more, the previous double-dip recession that the national economy had was in the early 80s, and you remember what that did to state budgets at that time. So,
Dr. Stinson, hypothetically, let's suggest the worst case. One, we find ourselves having trouble with capital gains revenue that accentuates where Minnesota is. And I assume if Minnesota is having problems with capital gains, that it won't be unique. And let's say Mr. Laufenberg is half right. And the half right part of his forecasting, as I think the article pointed out, he has a national reputation for his forecasting ability. Let's say that Mr. Laufenberg is half right to the extent that 2009 we continue to be in a recession. So if he's half right in that respect, and there are problems with capital gains, this could be a significant recession.
Mr. Chairman, somewhere in the back of the book here, anyway, we make a statement that no one can forecast the path of the economy 5 years into the future, but actual revenues for 2010, 2011 could exceed or fall short of the planning estimates by $2.5 billion, and so that kind of gives you an idea of of the size of the potential problem that could emerge should the absolute worst scenario come about.
And if that happens, for our purposes on this committee, in this legislature, if we have a forecast for 10-11 that's an additional billion and a half beyond what is forecast right now, that is significantly worse than 2003 because there won't be any one-time money, any one-time reserves separate from what we would do with a K-12 shift or something like that. We won't have as many options as we're as this legislature had in 2003.
Mr. Chairman, you know, it may sound strange to hear this, but in the summer of 2001, before we knew we were in a recession and before 9/11, when we went to the rating agencies, we made the case, and I think it was a legitimate case, that we were better positioned than any other state in the nation to deal with the downturn in the economy that we thought we were going to have to deal with. We had the reserves. We had a balance in the out years after counting inflation. We had money left on the bottom line in the current year. We'd actually paid for some federal tax law changes that we were going to have to do for conformity. We paid for them in advance. We had the tobacco endowment. So we had all of those tools that we could use, all those risk management pots of money that we could use. And you remember it was still a very difficult situation. So so you're absolutely right.
Let me ask something else. As a politician, I'm certainly happy to speak in rhetorical flourishes, but the governor has suggested that this is, I believe, and I hope I'm not misstating this, that last week he stated that this was a spending problem on the part of Minnesota, not a tax problem. And the rhetoric on the other side has been that this is a tax problem. We don't have enough revenue. It strikes me that it's neither. In this instance, this is a national economic problem. We have an exacerbation in Minnesota because of our job growth, but the subprime crisis, what's going on with energy prices, it strikes me that we're in there with everybody else. Dr. Stinson, is that a fair assessment?
Mr. Chairman, Minnesota's economy is not removed from the national economy. You know, rising tide lifts all ships, but when the tide goes out, all ships go down as well. And this is certainly the tide going out. So it is a national problem. And it again, it's accentuated in Minnesota because it's centered in the housing area. The housing area is an important sector for Minnesota, given our lumber and wood products industry. The areas where growth is occurring in the national economy, the energy exploration processing, that's not a significant sector for Minnesota. The other area where the growth is occurring in the national economy, defense material, that's, again, not an area where Minnesota is particularly well positioned. And so we're being hit a little bit harder by this, but everybody's being hit by it. I think the governor actually had some numbers saying how many states were looking at deficits, and I'm sure even more are, given that people don't make forecasts on a regular basis. So.
Okay. Thanks. Other questions? Senator Frederickson.
Chairman, Dr. Stinson. You talked about some sectors of our economy that are down, but we still have a pretty large agricultural sector in Minnesota, and farmers, and I would presume the whole agricultural sector, is doing very well. To what extent did you and the Council of Economic Advisors incorporate that sector into this forecast?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Frederickson, as you know, I think I have a wheat ranch, and so I'm well aware of what's happened to the prices of wheat over the last
year
or so.
Could you pull the mic? I'm sorry. I'd like to hear what you're saying, and I can't.
Anyway, I'm very aware of what's happened to prices in the agricultural sector over there, and so we have put that in, and that's helped. That helped the economic outlook for Minnesota, but the agricultural sector by itself isn't enough to lift the Minnesota economy when the U.S. economy is falling down.
Senator Dill.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Stinson, I've been quoting you in some of my speeches the last month or so.
That's dangerous.
And listening to you again today, I think I'm correct on part of it, at least. I've been saying that according to the state economist, most recessions last about 10 months and some last only about 8 months, and I think you've kind of said that in some ways again today. And then we've also talked about how long they could last with a double dip and so forth, but I didn't quite get the number of months on that. What's the outside? How long is the longest one we could expect?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, well, you know, it wasn't a recession, but the Great Depression lasted a long time. And so you could imagine a situation where this went on and on and on and on and on and went on for several years. We're just much more familiar with how to deal with working with policy tools, and we're less likely to make as many mistakes as were made in dealing with the Great Depression. So it's, you know, it's highly unlikely it would extend on there. But given a really bad worst-case scenario, this could extend more than a year without any problem, even with the temporary interruption of the stimulus package in there. I don't want to go into any great deal of discussion about the things that could go wrong, but the simple description is that two companies, AMBAC and MBIC, have insured a lot of things other than municipal bonds. They've insured a lot of other credits that are being held by banks and other financial institutions. As long as these two companies have AAA credit ratings, the credits that they have insured are rated AAA. If their credit rating drops to AA plus or AA, the credit that was insured by them, that becomes a AA plus or a AA credit as well, because the underlying insurance, the insurer's credit rating is what's reflected in the rating given to that particular credit. If that occurs, then obviously the value of a package of collateralized mortgages, for example, would go down because it's no longer a AAA credit. It's rated AA or AA plus. That would cause banks to have to reprice the value of these things in their holdings, and that could create a problem. The second thing is, for some financial institutions, would violate their conditions under which they can hold particular credits, and so they would have to get rid of them. And so this would create another flurry of uncertainty in financial markets, similar to what went on in August, which created the problem here. So, you know, if you're concerned about these things, as a lot of people are, one of the things that you should be watching is for what the news is on AMBAC and MBIC, that's something. If that all gets resolved, ratings are good for them and stable, you know, then we've worked our way through a lot of problems. But if, as long as they're a little bit shaky, there's going to be a lot of uncertainty in the credit markets.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How does Minnesota fare with the falling value of the dollar? And will we be more impacted or less impacted as the dollar keeps going down?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stumpf, the demand for Minnesota-produced goods will obviously increase as the value of the dollar goes down. The price for Minnesota consumers consuming goods that are purchased, you know, that are imported, is obviously going to go up. The real question is on the net side. And here I've got to confess I don't know that it used to be that when grain prices were low, if the value of the dollar went down, we'd sell a lot more grain, and so that had helped the agricultural economy in the state. You know, it was pretty clear that that would help us. At this point, given that grain prices are so high, and given that the export markets for grain aren't for subsistence, but rather are for improving the diet of people in countries. It's not you've got to have it or you starve. It's that this allows you to have more protein in your diet. It seems to me that in the grain area that this is going to choke off exports of grain with these higher prices, and so it's probably going to be negative since grain prices overall have gone up so much. It's going to reduce the amount of export activity we have. In there.
One second.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, how much of the recession or the potential length of it can be attributed to psychological factors? If you think things are going to get worse, it changes your behavior and it helps make it worse.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, certainly that's right, and that's why people didn't start talking about a recession last August when a lot of the problems were first apparent. I mean, people that understood what was going on understood that once the credit markets froze up the way they did in August, that there was a high probability of a recession going on, but people didn't talk about it publicly. More recently, though, I don't think that this is making very much difference in there. People know that people are being laid off. Once you have actual statistics showing, as they did before they were revised, that in December we actually lost private sector jobs, and then in January we actually lost jobs overall in the country. That's pretty obvious that that the economy is not performing at a rate that should be, and that individuals know that people are being laid off. They hear stories about what's going on in their firm, that jobs are less secure in their firm. And so, you know, at that point, I don't think that it was much of a problem. You notice that most economists, with a few notable exceptions, waited until after the first of the year to call a recession in there. And at that point, I think the writing on the wall was pretty self-evident.
Senator Foley, Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, it strikes me that the people who have the most assets here maybe felt this hit first, because you were talking about the losses in individual and corporate income tax, and those coming from non-wage income. And so I'm wondering, and it kind of relates to Senator Olson's comments about perception. If the losses are not coming so much in the individual income, has the job loss been that significant for the average worker? Because it doesn't seem to be showing up in this as much as losses or declines in non-wage income.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, you're confusing what occurred compared to what had occurred in the past to with what we're showing, which is a change in the forecast. We already had very weak employment growth forecast for 2008, so we didn't have to bring it down very much. We weren't forecasting that Minnesota employment was going to grow at the same rate it did in 2007. So if you look at what's actually going on, then what you see is really not very strong economic growth in Minnesota over the last couple of years. Now, in November when we did the forecast, we had data that showed that between June and October, we had lost something on the order of 20,000 jobs in Minnesota. So that's not change in forecast. That's just absolute job loss. And over that period, we'd have expected to have gained between 10 and 15,000 jobs under a normal situation. That data has since been revised. And what we found is that with the new data that we didn't lose those jobs, but we didn't gain them either. And that over the last 2 years, we've gained something like 17,000 jobs, I think. Let me see. Yeah, 17,000 jobs over the last 2 years, of which 8,500 were between December and January of 2008. So we're not adding jobs. Normally in a year we would add 40,000, 50,000. In a good year we might even add 60,000 or more. Now we're adding 25,000 in 2 years. Those are the numbers that are out there.
So, Mr. Chairman, it is kind of a chicken and egg thing. If we're losing jobs, it's because people don't have enough confidence to take the actions that actually perpetuate those. So it's kind of a chicken egg. Which did they lose the confidence and therefore not go forward, and therefore it's had this impact, or vice versa? I guess you can argue each side, but.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson. But if it's because they lost confidence, they lost confidence more than 2 years ago, because that's when the slow growth started.
Mm-hmm. Senator Foley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Dr. Stinson, one of the things that I look back on in days where I was door knocking, why I found that there's a significant number of the population, in my district at least, that is in great trouble because they mortgaged their house to the hilt. They got loans on all of the motorcycles and boats and all of that sort of thing. And when we look at that versus if you look back, you were talking about the depression. And frankly, I don't see any real relation there at this point. What are your thoughts on that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Foley, the Great Depression, I'm not saying that we're going into a Great Depression, or I'm not saying that we're going into a recession that's going to last several years or anything like that. I think this is going to be a relatively short, mild recession, last 6 months. There's a risk that we would have another down quarter in the first quarter of 2009, but I wouldn't plan for the state's finances based on thinking that this recession was going to be as severe as the recession of the 1980s even. But that said, you're absolutely right about the problem of overextended credit. And people, because interest rates were very cheap, were able to take advantage of credit. It wasn't particularly expensive for them to take advantage of credit and have all the things that they wanted and more than they could afford. I mean, it's pretty much human nature to uh, to want more things in there. And if you don't have experience with higher interest rates, I mean, I know you went through, just by looking at your age, I know that you're of an age where the double-digit inflation of late 1970s, early 1980s was something that's in the back of your mind, but there are a lot of people who weren't managing their family's finances during that period, and so they don't realize how quickly things can turn on them.
You frankly, I like your approach there, Mr. Chairman and Dr. Stinson. However, much of what I remember relates to the 30s and the situation that existed there that was essentially the same as it is today, is that people in the job market are going downhill, and the kinds of jobs are not helpful to our economy. I mean, we can't live on many of the jobs that we have in Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Foley, you know, I don't remember the 30s since I wasn't born, but I've read about them, and, you know, there are a couple of vignettes that I try to share with my students at the university in my macroeconomics class, and one of them is a picture of a sign on a grain elevator in North Dakota which says corn minus 5 cents a bushel. So, you know, not only weren't they paying you for it, but if you brought it to the elevator, you had to pay them a nickel a bushel to take it off your hands. The second thing is that we had unemployment rates over 25% at that time. And, you know, 25% unemployment rates today would be tragic, but we have so many dual-income households today that it wouldn't be near as tragic as it was in the 30s when there weren't dual-income households. And so with 25% unemployment, that meant 25% of the population households probably were without income in there. And we didn't have those kinds of social safety net things like unemployment insurance, Social Security, things like that. So, you know, the Depression really was a terrible thing in there.
Do you see some effect the war had? It seems to me the Depression in the 30s and 40s would have never really ended if it hadn't been that we went to war and it helped the economy, put a lot of people to work and so forth. And I'm wondering what the effect of today's work environment and
Mr. Chairman, Senator Foley, you know, it can be debated whether we would have gotten out of the Depression without World War II, but certainly World War II and the deficit spending that was necessary to make sure that we were producing the defense goods that were necessary to defend the country, you know, that certainly made a lot of difference and got us out of there. If you look at the current economic situation, it seems to me that the war has been bad for the economy, and it's been bad in two ways. One is if you look at what happened to employment after the bottom of the 2001 recession, it didn't grow. Usually after a month or two, it begins to start picking up again, and it grows, and within a year, you're back to where you were when the recession started in terms of employment, and after 2 years, you're well above that. In this economy, it took 4 years for us to get back to where the recession, where employment was at the time the recession started. And if you look at the data, what you see is you see that the economy started to recover, and then as there was more uncertainty brought on about whether we were going to invade Iraq or not, the economy weakened again, because with all that uncertainty, you know, do you make the business investment decisions? Do you hire people tooling up for it, given that you don't know? And so that delayed the situation, the recovery, put us on a slower path. And then after that, the fact that we haven't treated spending for the war in a responsible financial management way has created a situation where we've had deficits that have, you know, eventually caused us a weaker dollar, and they've just generally created some problems. And so, you know, I think World War II probably was a big help to get us out of the Great Depression. I think this the economic impacts of this war probably have hurt the economy's overall progress.
That's interesting.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you for spending the time with us. Always learn a lot from Commissioner Hansen, Mr. Showalter, but particularly Dr. Stinson. It's some of the best testimony we hear in this place. So appreciate your being here for most of us. And now we'll try to figure out how to deal with the deficit. So –